Many, many years ago, when I was in graduate school, the first time when dinosaurs roamed the earth, and this was in the late 80s, I was invited to a party at one of my professor's homes. And so for graduate students, that was kind of a command performance. You show up when your professor invites you to a party. And I went a little kind of nervous because this was a very capable, very smart teacher, but she also had and enjoyed a bit of a reputation for being difficult, rough, some could say. Which was good. It kind of helped us sort of shape into what we needed to become, but she didn't take a lot of guff. But she invited us to this party, and we were there. My future wife was there with me, which was good. And I'll tell you why it was good, because in the middle of the conversation, we're all kind of gathered around in her front room, and I can't remember what the conversation was about, but I remember saying something stupid. Okay. Now, at the time, I did not know how stupid it was. And I, to this day, cannot tell you what the stupid thing was that I said. But I know, it's probably good that I can't remember what it was. I wouldn't tell you. Because I remember, like, oh, man. So I did like so many people do when they say stupid things without fully understanding what they've done. I doubled down. Amen? Yeah. Oh, yeah? Well, I'm not going to put up with that. Let me just tell you again in the worst way. So I don't know. I don't know what it was. But I said the even more offensive thing, thinking that I was, you know, making my point, justifying whatever it was. I wish I could remember what it was. But I said it worse. And then, you know, kind of in a private moment, I said to my wife, or my future wife, who was assessing me the whole time, like, is this a person I really want to hang out with? Or... I said, I was kind of reading some negative feedback there, and she said, yes, and here's why. And she corrected the stupid for me. This is why we have good friends, right? There are times in our lives that we won't get it, but someone, our spouse, our good friends, somebody can help us sort of think through things. I had not thought through what I was saying. And so I stuck around, and you know, I said, we gotta stay till the end. I wanted to run out of the house, you know, and bury my head somewhere and hope that I would never have to have her in class ever again. But it was a small department. There was no way of doing that. And I just knew, I just can't let this go. So I, throughout that party, I fretted. Do you know what I mean by fret? It's anxiety, but painful. I fretted and fretted and thought, oh, what am I going to say? Oh, she's going to let me have it. Oh, I will be so embarrassed. And I worked my way through all those anxieties and I could not like make them go away. Could not have it disappear. But the party came to a close, and it was the moment that I had been kind of dreading but waiting for. And I went to her and to her husband and apologized for what I said. And said, I really had not considered what I was saying, and I'm sorry if that was disruptive to this lovely evening. And then I waited. Make that face with me, like, oh, this is going to sting, you know, this is going to hurt. And my professor was the picture of grace. Yeah, you know, I was so petrified of what she would say, and deservedly. But she was like, we all make mistakes. And thank you for coming to me. And don't sweat it. Now, I could not turn that into cachet on the next test. But I had a sense of who I was in a better way, and certainly who this person was. So we went from one understanding and one struggle to something deeper. That's the beauty sometimes of making things right, of working through that struggle and fret, because it can take us to a different place. Now, one of the core principles, one of the key steps within the recovery community is that of making amends. You mess things up, you try to fix it. By the way, that's what they teach in preschool too. You can see how effective that is. And Ann Dillard tells a remarkable story. And she's a great writer. If you have not read her work, then it's worth going to. Anne tells a story of being part of a Presbyterian church. We will forgive her for that. But being part of a Presbyterian church and leading a Sunday school class for children. And the Sunday school class was growing, and she got to the place of feeling a little frustrated that there were only a handful of teachers, just a few teachers for the kids. And so in a gathering of her church one time, she got up and said, "Why aren't you," and she named out some groups and some individuals, "why aren't you being part of this Sunday school class?" And got really personal and ugly. And, we just let them have it. And it didn't go well, right? Conversations like that tend not to yield what you hope for. And she learned that. But in the middle of all that, she got hurt herself. And she started thinking some very ugly things about people that were in her church and in that group. And she knew that was not right. She was part of the recovery community herself. And so even for those thoughts, she knew this was not something to have around. Because, thoughts, they're rarely private. They come out. Sometimes they come out indirectly, or sometimes they come out in behavioral expressions, but goodness gracious, they come out. And certainly, that's the kind of stuff that Jesus talks about. You have heard it said, do not murder. Right? But I'm telling you, don't talk about each other. Don't gossip and revile each other behind, each other's back. Don't tell stories about each other. Because that's, in a way, committing, character assassination. That's murder. So Anne calls up the first person, the person that she had the most difficulty with, those thoughts. And, come on, you've had those thoughts too. She calls up that person and says, "I'm sorry. And one of the reasons why I'm sorry is that I've had some really ugly thoughts." That's really radically fixing things. And they had a frank conversation, and it wasn't necessarily pretty through all of it. She describes that well in her book, Plan B. But she got through it. And she learned some things about herself and about the other person. And there was the emergence of something new through that wrestling. Now, Jacob has a brother. His name is Esau. They were the sons of Isaac. Remember we talked about Isaac last week? Oh, laughter. Right? Well, laughter had two boys, and there wasn't a lot of laughing going on in their household. Esau was born first. Jacob was born second. But the story on Jacob is that he was grabbing his brother's heel as he was, you know, being born, as if to say, let me in front. You know how siblings are. You know how siblings are. Oh, no, you didn't. I'm, you know. And so there was always contention between those boys. In fact, the word, the name Jacob, by the way, is anyone in here named Jacob? Good, because the name Jacob means heel grabber, right? So if you're thinking about Jacob for a name of a child or a grandkid or a dog or whatever, just remember you're calling him heel grabber. That had an interesting, led to an interesting conversation in a previous church where there was a few Jacobs in the church, but that's another story. So Jacob and Esau are in constant conflict with each other. Jacob's kind of sneaky and a bit duplicitous and is working with his mama, with his mom, to figure out how to get into the place of being the son of honor. Now, remember, this is a culture and a time when firstborn sons are the deal. In fact, that's where lines of inheritance go. That's where responsibility goes. We have kind of worked through that in a different way, but there are still, you know, the impact of the firstborn, particularly the firstborn son, in this particular context. And so that firstborn son, he's the deal. And Jacob and his mama, not once, but twice, cheat Esau out of that position. Have you heard the story? Some of you have. And then once he does it the second time, he figures that Esau is probably going to kill him. So he gets out of town. When you realize that you're in trouble, you get out of town. And that's what he did. Now, interestingly, he left town, he wandered from one place into another place, and he found himself brought into a home, interested in a girl. Girls will always mess you up. Interested in a girl, said to the father of the girl, can I marry your daughter? Absolutely, sure. And the daughter tricks him into marrying the other daughter, which shows you what goes around. No, that's not... That's not what I wanted to say. But it is interesting, though, how the table is turned, right? And so there is the second daughter who he marries as well, okay? Now, that's not normative for what we understand, you know, human sexual relationships to be. But right there it is in a biblical way, and nobody blinks an eye. What happens is he is wealthy. He actually flourishes in the environment that he is with his two wives and his 11 boys and all the other things that you heard that he carried with him. But he had the experience of being called back home. He was called back home and led back home. And the Lord is saying to him at several points along the way, along the journey, I'm going to take care of you. This mess with Esau is not going to destroy you, although you think it is, and maybe deservedly. Come home. You know, this is where we get the ideas of how God is providing for us, even in those long journeys like Jacob's ladder. Have you heard of that? It's like, oh. So Jacob is on the verge of meeting his brother again. And this is on the edge. And he does what he normally does. He tries to figure out how to game the situation. He first sends presents for his brother across the stream, across the river. And then he sends the rest of his retinue, the rest of his children, his wives, his servants, all the goats and the camels and, you know, the whole thing, figuring that the presents didn't take care of Esau, then Esau would take the rest of it by force And if that, you know, hopefully that would sate, that would kind of take care of what Esau needed to figure out that he needed to take care of, and at least Jacob might survive, might escape with his life alone, right? So even still, he's just a scoundrel. So Jacob sends across the water all those things, and he's getting ready to cross over that night. Even as God has loved, by the way, God loves scoundrels. Did you know this? So the scoundrel is waiting to go over the next morning, and here comes the stranger, and a wrestling match ensues. I don't know how it started. You know, did he walk up and insult him? Did he say, I don't like your shoe, sandals? You know, did he, like, come on, it's like, let's get it on. Was it like WWE? I don't know. I think it was more like high school wrestling. Have you ever watched a high school wrestling match? It's really kind of intense, very competitive, and nobody's yelling at each other in the midst of that. It's not like Hulk Hogan and Rowdy Roddy Piper. Anybody remember these folks? All right, so there is Jacob and this stranger, and they wrestle. And they wrestle all through the night. And the sun is about to come forward. I can't imagine what it is to, you know, to wrestle someone for like 10, 15 minutes, like you do with your kids sometimes, is exhausting. I needed a nap when I would wrestle with my kids. But all night, in a reality. So he is in this place. The man who he's wrestling with, who came to him to wrestle, who initiated this conflict, the man says to him, sun's about to come up, let me go. And Jacob says, I'm not letting you go until you bless me. That's pretty presumptive, but that's what needed to happen. Now, let me just skip ahead and remind you that we hear at the very end of this story that Jacob understands that he has been wrestling with God, or the manifestation of God's messenger. All right. So this wasn't just any ordinary dude. This was God initiating the contact, stepping into the wrestling match, and willingly, I mean, God condescends to kind of come down and wrestle this scoundrel. Because he has something for him to do, and he is committed to looking after him. Sometimes God will find a way to enter into even the hardest moments and wrestle with us. Now, notice what happens. The whole situation, the anxiety about, oh, I'm going to see Esau. Oh, this is bad. I might lose everything. I might lose my life. All that anxiety and all that fretting was not as important. That God entering into that anxiety and wrestling actually redeemed and transformed the whole situation, because he gets to the end. He gets to the moment where he's asked for the blessing, and God is ready to bless him. And he says to him, you know, you were this. What's your name? Heel grabber. Not anymore. You were this, but now you are Israel. You had been this, but now together you and I have become this. And as you may know, from that line of Abraham, all through that is the formation of an incredible manifestation of the people of God, a people of God who loved God so much, even in their messes, even in their scoundrels, even in their obscenities, loved God so much that they were able to offer a blessing to the rest of the world, including Jesus, right? So you and I find ourselves in a place, curiously, hardly, of wrestling through our own messes, those things that we're confronting in our own lives. We're wrestling as a community. We're wrestling individually. There are things that are still kind of in your head. There's something in your head right now, I would imagine. How is God looking to transform that and you in the midst of this? What will be the next step? How will you be blessed? You might not even know. Or you might be very clearly understanding this is happening. One final thing I just want to say. Jacob didn't come out of this without being wounded. You know, he has a permanent limp marking that transformation for the rest of his life. People honored that by not eating the flesh around that in animals, but he was marked and handicapped and then given the ability to live and move forward nonetheless. How is that happening with you?